The Packet Pushers podcast is pleased to take you deep into the bowels of the Cisco cyborg today, shooting lasers down fiber optic cables and bouncing from leaf to spine as we explore scalable data center architectures. Yes, Cisco has sponsored today's show, desiring to share with you, our talented group of network engineers the world over, their unified fabric product. So, sit up straight, open a fresh batch of whiteboard markers, inhale deeply, and start drawing up a brand new design. I am Ethan Banks, at EC Banks on Twitter, and with me is Mr. Greg Farrell. Greg, how you doing, sir?
I am doing tippity-top all of the day to you, sir. How are thou as well?
Having a heck of a week. One of those weeks where my inbox doth overflow, and I actually had a really bizarre moment yesterday where I was sitting there with four IM screens open in various flavors, and my email box was going, and I had so many messages hitting me all at once. I just kind of froze up. It was like buffer overflow, and I just kind of broke for a second there. I actually was sitting here at my desk. I couldn't actually move. I didn't actually know what to do next. It was a very disturbing moment. And then I kind of got up and walked out of my office, and then I came back, and everything was okay.
Welcome to silly season. It's that time of the year in your network architect design career where every year from, what is it, late July, sort of get started in August, and then now down till November, the vendors love to tell us all about their new products. It's crazy season.
Well, it's that, and it's the conferences as well. So, I mean, at this point, it was last week or so that we were at, or I was at VMworld, and then next week there's a networking field day event I'm headed out to, and then I'm getting ready for Interop. And so all of these things are just kind of converging on the month of September and making it, as you said, silly season for sure. You know, let alone all the announcements of people trying to schedule for briefings and so on.
Definitely.
Good times. Well, let's introduce our guests from Cisco. And first up, we've got Lucas Kratiger. Lucas, would you please introduce yourself and tell folks what you do for Cisco?
Sure. Hi, guys. Hi, Ethan. Hi, Greg. Yeah, so my name is Lucas Kratiger. I'm a technical marketing engineer within Cisco. I'm working in that group responsible for the Nexus 2K, 5K, 6K, 7K. And, well, what are we doing? We're trying to put together some new acronyms do the plumbing thing.
Yeah, okay. And Lucas, you've brought along with you Shyam Kapadia. And Shyam, same thing for you. Would you please introduce yourself and tell folks what you do for Cisco?
Hi, Heaton. Hi, Greg. My name is Shyam Kapadia. I'm a technical lead in the data center software group. I've been working on the unified fabric innovations that we're going to talk about more today over the past 2+ years, and I'm really excited to be here.
Lucas, let me kick the show off by asking you a question here. Now, Cisco had a marketing term around this product called Dynamic Fabric Automation for a while there, but now you're referring to it as Unified Fabric. So did we have a rebranding here? Is there a broadening of scope in the product? How do we best understand the branding?
Hey, awesome question. So the Unified Fabric itself is here for how long does the Nexus series exist? Like for years, right? Mm-hmm. Almost a decade, close to a decade now. So I mean, this is there, and what we're doing is basically we're trying to show innovation into the unified fabric, which is that long-term brand we are having and which we want to reemphasize with this show here, of course, as well. The reason why we want to stick with unified fabric is basically everything comes together. And if you guys need an acronym, I mean, I have one. We call that show Building Simplified, Automated, and Scalable Data Center Network with Unified Fabric, or BSASDCNUF. So here you have the acronym. And BS does not stand for bullshit, right?
Yeah. I'm so glad you kept it short and memorable.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, okay. We always do. We're in the world of more than 3-letter acronyms now. That's a new invention.
Yeah, the ETLA.
Okay, so Unified Fabric, this is a product set then that rests on that very familiar Nexus product lineup. It sounds like it's all of the Nexus products that are built on custom Cisco silicon. You said you ran through 2K, 5K, 6K, 7K, is that right?
Of course, absolutely, yes.
Cisco's created this product, Unified Fabric, that runs on top of this Nexus product set that many of the listeners are familiar with. So first of all, at a high level, just what is it? Try to encapsulate, you know, at a very high level, just what this thing is, and then let's get into some of the reasons why it got built.
Sure, Ethan. So very simply said, we want to have more automation more simplification, and of course, more innovation in our products. So that whole stuff needs to go hand in hand, automated, click in, works. That's the main purpose of the whole story here.
Okay. So let's just stop there for a second. So Unified Fabric is, it sounds like it's an automation tool that that data centers can use to build out a fabric across the data center using the Nexus product line. So is it a software layer that kind of plugs into the Nexus gear and then that builds out the leaf spine architecture?
First of all, it is nothing else than networking. It's mature protocols, well-known engineered protocols, just with a little bit of secret sauce to it. Yes, there is a software component on top of it. We call that fabric management. Just to model the network itself and to abstract it, how we did it with UCS Manager, re-abstract the resources, the hardware from the management. And it's management. It's not a controller, right? It's very important.
We're not ceding control of the network to a controller. It is still a distributed control plane. There is just a management element that is helping us to get the network configured, if you will.
Exactly. It's a management and provisioning approach we are doing there. And it's very different than how network provisioning has been done in the past. It is about modeling the network, preparing it, building it then, meaning powered it up then. And once you're done there, the tenant configuration, the host, the VLANs, the SVIs and so on, they're not there. This is the next step in there, and it's completely automated if you want to.
So let me just have a go at that just to make sure I get it as well, right? So I've got a network full of the gear I've probably already got. So I've got 7,000s, 5,000s, 6,000s, smatterings of thousands with the word Nexus in them, in the ever-growing product family that Cisco's got in that space. And I get in with the CLI and I run around and type stuff. I've probably spent weeks beforehand thinking about what I'm going to type and how it's all going to work and working out what it is. And then all of a sudden, I've got to get every single typing command exactly right to get the intention that I want. What we're talking about here in the Unified Fabric is saying all of those protocols that I would have configured manually, I can now model in a separate application. So I can configure tenants, using protocols like BGP and MPLS and LDP. I can have routing and all that type of stuff. But what I've done is I've got another app which actually models it in software and then delivers those configurations onto the switches for you. Is that correct?
So let me break it down. That is mostly correct. But so you can think of the configuration on the switches in two ways. One is the day zero configuration, where you need to have the baseline configuration in terms of having the management IP addresses, the control plane, the BGP configurations, etc., which are really not tenant specific. This is a bootstrapping process, if you may, of the Unified Fabric to make sure that it's ready with respect to the control plane and the data plane. And then you have the day one config, which is essentially what you mentioned as tenant specific, where depending on the active tenant workloads, you may want to have the tenant WRF, the tenant SVIs, the VLANs, the ACLs, whatever resources that are required to forward traffic for the tenant needs to be allocated on that specific TOR or leaf, as we call it. And in this way, with the combination of the day zero and the day one config, we have the fabric set up both from a point of view of control plane as well as data plane.
And the big deal there is no one had to go to the command line, as Greg was describing earlier, from switch to switch to switch to make that happen. There's a model that you create that has that information in it, and then as the fabric comes online and talks to the management piece, that configuration element is pushed down into the fabric, all the switches that make up that fabric.
That's right. So the day zero configuration, we use a process called POAP, or Power On Auto Provisioning, and it's sort of the enhanced version of POAP. POAP has been shipping on the Nexus product line for a few years now, but we've enhanced it so that you can customize the configuration based on a particular device and have that pushed to that device in an automated way as soon as the device comes up online. And we've made templates that allow you to consistently apply these over a set of switches. Maybe you have a set of switches that you want to have the same sort of configurations, but maybe there are some unique properties like the management IPs or the loopback IPs, et cetera, which are specific to a particular device. And we have a fairly nice way in which this can be pushed to devices as they come online. And the other part of it is what you mentioned in terms of the tenant configurations getting pulled to the leaf from the fabric controller where the configuration repository resides. And as the tenant workloads come in, the pull-based mechanism ensures that we scale in an effective way because we only pull configuration when it is needed. We call this just-in-time provisioning or just-in-time configuration. And as soon as the resources are no longer required, maybe the workloads are powered down or the workloads move away from a particular below a particular leaf, the configuration is aged out. So you have this thing where, okay, you want these configurations, but after the party is over, no one really wants to clean up. And that's very important because you have all these resources that are lying about there, which may not be required anymore, and they can be repurposed and reused for new tenant workloads that come about.
Hmm. Okay, so there's a lot here that we've said, and I think now we kind of have a general idea of what this is and what it's doing for us. So let's take a step back and go, what was the motivation for this? Why other than simplification, why was this product created?
So with the motivations behind, look at the traditional networks out there. Traditionally, we started somewhere with spanning tree and HSRP. We had a single active link. We had a single forwarding or layer 2, layer 3 demarcation. Then we went into something like multi-chassis link aggregation, VSS or VPC in Cisco term, where we started having active-active kind of gateways. But still, we had a network choke point, right? We had that north-south of topology or optimized for north-south traffic. We had that active-active kind of point. But everything had to go through this centralized, polarized point in the network. Now, with the approach we choose in here, not only from a topology perspective, where we're looking at the cluster spine leaf architecture, also from a role, what we are doing exactly where, it's very, very different. Think about that. I mean, Greg, Ethan, you guys do that stuff here with networking for many years. Think about having the same virtual IP gateway on more than 300 leaves at the same time.
So yeah, you have an equal point of entry anywhere you're at. You virtualize that gateway IP so that it's anywhere in the fabric that a host needs it to be.
Exactly. Wherever a host is, we have the gateway. And how does it scale in traditional first-hop redundancy protocol where you have a state which you need to exchange, like hellos? It does not, right? It's a huge overhead you're having there. But by using an Anycast approach, and I'm talking here about the Anycast technology itself, it's very, very efficient and it's completely stateless. It's just a matter of how you present the gateway in which direction to the host.
And as Anycast, it's not magical. It's a well-known protocol that's accomplishing this.
It's not even a protocol. It's just a term, right?
Yeah,
it's just
sure,
a term
yeah.
of using the closest point in the network, which is attractive for me.
Well, if you think about it,
default gateway.
I mean, the default gateway is always just about where do I go to get to other subnets, right? And the reason that we've only ever had the default gateway in one place was because there was no way to distribute the state of, you know, who's got the default gateway and who's forwarding for this before. So if you're going to have 20 routers as the default gateway for a given subnet all across the fabric, you've got to have some way of saying to each of those routers, you're the default gateway, and then once you get this packet, you've got to do something with it. Sure?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right? And now it's not 20, it's up to 384.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, you know, conceptually for the people who are listening, you know, think about it. The only reason that we have default gateways in the core router, you know, or at some point in the routing infrastructure is because it can only exist in one place, because with manual configuration, you can only have it in one place.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you've got to have a protocol saying, you know, you're all the default gateway and you've all got to coherently come together. And you can't do that if you're doing manual configuration. You have to have some other system. And that's part of what Unified Fabric is trying to achieve, is this way of saying you're all default gateways and here's all the information you need to all be default gateways.
That's right. So that you accurately identified, the reason the gateway is usually at one point is because in the conventional sense, it's this place where you route from in and out of the subnet. If I put my gateway at multiple locations, this is what we call as a distributed or Anycast or pervasive gateway, if you may, there is something needed to make sure that the host information that is captured by the gateways, so let's say a Tor serves as a gateway for all the hosts, physical or virtual, below it. Now that host information or the set of host information, the IPs, MACs, etc., they need to be advertised and told to all the other Tors, all the other remaining 300 odd Tors, right? Mm-hmm. We use MPBGP or multi-protocol BGP to achieve this. So in general, like you identified, as long as I have a distributed pervasive gateway, I need a mechanism, some sort of control plane to ensure that the host addresses are told from every Tor to every other Tor, because I still want to have distributed subnets. I still want to have my any subnet anywhere, any workload anywhere. So that's exactly what you identified. And we achieve that by using, once again, multi-protocol BGP, which is a BGP being a hard state protocol, and IBGP is very well known to scale to a large number of hosts and IP.
Well, more prefixes. Importantly, it's in the boxes today, right? So yes. We don't have to go and strap on some new piece of code and wait years for it to prove out as reliable. We can just, it's there, you strap on a small thread that says, here's some extra data for you to propagate around it, boom, done.
Absolutely. And just to extend this a bit further, the typically, like you mentioned, the BGP is well-known and multi-protocol BGP is tied very well with the Layer 3 VPN or L3 VPN, where we use MPLS as the end cap and L3 VPN address family to distribute the control plane information. So what we've done in the Unified Fabric is we've still leveraged the control plane for multi-protocol BGP or the L3 VPN address family just as people understand it today. But in the data plane, we have something called segment ID, which is a 24-bit identifier for uniquely identifying a VRF. So typically with MPLS, when you think about it, you have a VPN label that identifies a VRF.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Unified Fabric, we have the VRF identified by a segment ID. And you can think of it as a Layer 3 segment ID as opposed to a Layer 2 segment ID, which is essentially a 24-bit extension of what we know as today as a VLAN. So VLAN has 12 bits, right? So you can only have up to 4K VLANs, and that's basically the limit that people talk about within the data center, that I cannot have more than 4K. So by having a segment ID, we've allowed the number of potential VRFs and VLAN, or as you know as VLANs today, to be extended up to 16 million, because now you have 2^24 potential different segments that you can use to identify either a VRF or a Layer 3 network, if you may, or you can identify a subnet or an individual tenant subnet, which would be typically a VLAN, which now becomes a Layer 2 segment ID.
So that 24-bit ID, that is unique to this solution, and you're just using multi-protocol BGP to share that data? In other words, 24-bit segment IDs show up in a lot of different things these days, and VXLAN comes to mind. But we're not doing VXLAN NCAPs, it doesn't sound like here. You're using a different mechanism to identify these different segments that are mapped into to VRF structures.
So first of all, the data plane as it is today, it's fabric path based, and we use the approach of trail fine-grained labeling to extend the traditional .1Q approach. We're going with the standard, right? So even if you're having fabric path, which is frame routing or frame encapsulation, a frame-based overlay technology in the network, which is Cisco proprietary, we still use the existing trail specification for extending the namespace in there. Now, I want to make a very, very important point about what we are talking right now is completely NCAP agnostic. Whatever we choose as a forewarning encapsulation within the fabric, we can use it as long as we can extend the namespace. It's just a level of indirection. It's nothing else. And with this said, VXLAN is on our menu. It's just a matter of time you get it. And it will be most likely this year.
Yeah, you're going to be carrying VXLAN frames across or packets across your fabric. Because again, you said you're... you know, agnostic as far as what the data type is. You're just using the 24-bit ID to identify things end-to-end as a data chunk, a datagram, if you will, goes across the fabric. And then you can now, across what is essentially a fabric path or a trill-based fabric, do not just layer 2, but now do layer 3 and full multi-tenancy across that fabric.
Absolutely correct. That's what the story is, right? It's all about completely decoupling from a given NCAP itself, as long as it serves the purpose.
Mm.
It's being no religion anymore, right?
Yeah. No, I get it. I get it. There are there are competing technologies that do similar kinds of things in the shortest path bridging realm that I've heard about. So this is the first story I've heard from Cisco that's got similar functionality.
So let me take the shortest path bridging up very shortly. I mean, SPB is L2 technology in essence, and there are some enhancements in there to transport layer 3 information. But the SPB, even with the L3 approach, does not provide you a distributed gateway and does not provide you a multi-tenant and very scalable control plane to transport and host information across it, which is our MPBGP.
So when you say end-host information, I wanted to drill into that and qualify exactly what that is. And most engineers are going to think about identifying end-hosts in two ways. One, in an Ethernet context, a MAC address, and then two, in an IP context by some unique IP address that's been assigned to the host. So when you say we're carrying end-host information into the routing protocol, is it layer 2, layer 3, both, or something different?
So that's an excellent question, and I wanted to come to that. So the short answer to that is we are carrying the IP address. And like we mentioned, this is nothing but MPBGP with the layer 3 VPN address family. So essentially you're carrying the IP address of the host, associating it with the VRF in which that end host lies on. Mm-hmm. And that's the information that is distributed in the MPBGP control plane to all the TORs. So every TOR in the control plane is aware of all the hosts that are known to the fabric in that particular VRF. With respect, we do not distribute MAC addresses.
All Ethernet's going to end up being is effectively last mile delivery. Okay, we've traversed the fabric and now we're going to deliver this to the host. And okay, I guess Ethernet's the last mile. We'll do an NCAP and deliver it.
Yes. Now, since you've asked this, I think you're basically hinting at, okay, so we have this thing where what is the main, one of the main problems with bridging? One of the main problems with bridging is that if I do not know the DMACC, or if the DMACC lookup is a miss, then I flood. And if I flood, then basically it's going to flood throughout the fabric. It's going to go to all the TORs, and it's also going to go to the host, because you basically flood within that VLAN or within that segment in this case. And that's clearly not one of the attributes that we want to have in a fabric that you want to scale. So what we have introduced in addition is what we call as enhanced forwarding. Enhanced forwarding means that whether a host is talking to another host within the same subnet or within a different subnet, we handle traffic in the same way, meaning that we always do an IP-based lookup and forward the traffic to that destination, independent of whether it's in the same subnet or a different subnet. So you can think of it as routing within a subnet or routing across a subnet. We always route. By doing this, what this ensures is there is essentially no unknown unicast handling, no flooding within the fabric.
Mm. Okay, so just thinking about this, if you're using BGP to carry a list of host routes, which is sort of, you're saying every IP address of the end host is carried in the BGP, in an MPBGP session, then the possibility is that you could exceed the table because you have too many hosts and things like that. But again, because you have the central configuration engine, you can control the status of the whole fabric as a single element.
So just to answer that, we do not keep states in our fabric management about how the fabric
is configured.
Sorry,
not in the manager. But
yes. So every switch is completely independent of each other from what is configured on it. So think about scale-out architectures. It's exactly what it is. Do I really need to have a particular VLAN, a particular VRF on all of my switches? you probably don't, right? You do not need that. And with this, as Sham explained, we have that host route object, but we only have to have that host route object in our tables on a switch where we have the VRF instantiated on it. So this gives us a scale out on the overall routing perspective. In addition to that, you guys know about Fabric Path Layer 2 conversational learning. We introduce a similar approach for the Layer 3 part. So the downloads between the routing information base and the forewarning information base, the hardware table and the software table, can do that specifically and save with this resources only if conversations are required.
Yeah. Mm. So, yeah, it's partly managed by the controller, it's partly managed by the device itself. And, you know, you're saying if that IP address has no relevance to a particular device, then the device doesn't hold that state or that information.
Exactly. So, yep. I don't like your controller term. sorry, Greg, because let's go into that very, very specifically. If a host, an end host, comes online, the switch asks for a configuration out of the configuration repository, which is in the fabric management or the so-called controller. Yeah. The switch asks for it and downloads it. Done.
Right. It doesn't need to keep in contact with the controller except for that one boot.
Exactly.
Time, right? Sorry, I'm more thinking of it as
the instantiation part, which is there. No, you do it right, Greg. It's great. Yeah. It's a great discussion.
Yeah, I keep forgetting because I just think of the controller as an application. I don't think of it as a controller. Right.
Of course.
Because
even in SDN
environments, like there are a number of SDN products which the controller is purely a configuration device. Big Switch, for example, their mode of operation is that their controller makes a whole bunch of configuration, and then the switch boots and pulls the configuration down. And that's a true SDN company, but that's how they operate. There are too many different ways to achieve SDN that don't. So I just think using the word controller as shorthand for that application up there.
That's fine, Greg. There's so many ways to skin a cat. But let me bring in one thing. When we're looking at provisioning of networks in a very traditional way, people start building a network topology based on discovery and push configuration down to the switch based on discovery they have in a certain fabric management tool. So there is a requirement of having a top-down interaction between like a vCenter, for example, and that fabric management technology in order to specify where a certain virtual machine comes online. We are not doing this. Mm-hmm. Our interaction between the compute world, which is the end host coming online on the network, and the switch is the Ethernet wire.
Mm.
That's a completely different approach, right? It's completely It's standard-based communication. Or when you want to call it IEEE 802.1Q. We're looking at the VLAN ID there.
But you do integrate with virtual switches. So Nexus 1000V in VMware and KVMs and Hyper-Vs?
Of course, absolutely. So we do not care. When you think about a virtual switch, most likely he has a trunk to the physical switch. So we have the VLAN ID there. It just gets naturally transported over the wire. Mm-hmm. We receive it on the switch and do the certain action on it. Now, very specific to a couple of virtual switches, the Nexus 1000V from Cisco, as well as the OpenV switch, they have extension which is called VDP, Virtual Station
Interface Discovery Protocol.
You say it, Sham. Oh, man, that's a long name. And when we're talking about that VDP thing, it's 802.1QBG. It's, again, a standard we are using.
Yeah.
We extended it, we added a couple of clauses, and with this VDP standard, we not only this triggering configuration in a control plane kind of way, we're also exchanging information between the virtual and the physical world on the wire. You can call it CDP for virtual environments if you want to. You see the virtual machine name, the IP, the MAC, the Ethernet interface, the segment ID, all in the physical switch. Think about that. It's no integration with vCenter we require for this. None. It's really just a wire, the virtual switch talking to the physical switch.
I want to go back a little bit and talk about the scaling architecture again. We're talking about scale out versus scale up. And I'm remembering a show we recorded about Fabric Path a while ago and the fact that in a leaf spine architecture that runs on Fabric Path, the spines don't know about MAC addresses that live out at the edge because they don't need to. They just need to get data in between the leaves, and so it knows about leaves, and that's it. Is this a similar kind of a thing here? What do the spines know, and does that help us with scale?
Excellent. So this was also something that we wanted to discuss. And in a nutshell, what you mentioned is absolutely accurate. So why do people use network overlays? One of the things why overlays are used is they provide this level of indirection. And like you mentioned, in a typical class topology where you have a set of spines and a set of leaves, and the leaves pretty much connect to the spines, and the spines don't connect to each other, the spines are pretty much expected to be lean and dumb, if you may, because all they really need to know is how to forward traffic from an ingress tor to an egress tor. So they provide the diversity in terms of the ECMP or the L2MP. They don't need to know about anything about tenant workloads. The reason they don't need to know is because they basically only look at the overlay header and the forwarded traffic to the right tor. So all the intelligence is within the leaves. The leaves stamp in the overlay header along with the right segment ID, identifying the VRF or the layer 2 segment within which the traffic needs to be forwarded. That information is basically going to the spine. The spine doesn't even care or look at that. It basically looks at the destination switch ID in fabric path terms. Because you know the fabric path header has the switch ID in the outer header or the overlay header, and that is what the spines use to forward traffic to the right destination switch, where another forwarding lookup happens based on the segment ID stamped in the packet by the ingress leaf, and the packet is sent out. So in that sense, because you're pretty much only looking at the overlay header, you do not have any kind of tenant configuration existing on the spines, this ensures the spines are much more stable. This ensures that even if a spine goes away, there's no problem. Basically, the underlay, and as you would know, the fabric path uses ISIS to distribute the topology information amongst the different nodes. Mm-hmm. The underlay is what is going to indicate the connectivity or the topology information to all the nodes. Once this information is known, that's all that the spine requires in order to forward traffic between the leaves or the switches.
Okay, yep, makes good sense. And is similar to many other architectures that scale big, like MPLS, where tag switching means it doesn't really care what's inside, it just forwards based on the tag, and there's a lot of other things that that it just doesn't need to know about when you're forwarding in the core of a big MPLS environment. It's very similar here, except scaling for a data center. Another thought kind of popped in my head. Now, fabric path is not pure Trill as such. It is Trill plus Cisco extensions to the capabilities to make it a more capable transport. Are there elements here where it's the where some of this technology might make its way back into Trill standards that maybe Cisco's proposed?
Let me give that to Sham, and I think that's the right point. I mean, Sham and some of his colleagues were doing a book on using Trill, Fabric Path, and VXLAN for designing massive scalable data centers. So he is the expert on exactly this topic. And it's a Cisco press book. Oh, I did marketing, right? Sorry about that, Sham, it's on you.
Thank you, Lucas. So in a sense, and we briefly hinted at this, that we, for carrying the segment ID, we are adhering to the FGL or the fine-grained labeling standard, which is already a Trill extension. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, we are adhering to the standard. The fabric path header by itself, doesn't really change much from what has been, has been proposed earlier, where you're carrying the switch IDs predominantly within the outer headers. And you have the F tag, which is really the key, one of the key advantages that fabric path has, which Trill doesn't have within its base header. You actually need to have an extension header to have the topology information embedded within Trill. So, with those differences aside, at least with respect to carrying multi-tenancy information, we are fairly similar. Fabric Path and Trill are not really that different.
And we're doing more from the Trill standards. So we are also introduced for Fabric Path ISIS BFD, which basically also follows the BFD signalization for layer 2 ISIS, which has been used in Trill. that's using the same approach there. So if your question is, are we consuming everything of Trill? No, we don't. We have our own header. If you're feeding back everything we think makes sense, yes, of course. If it goes into the standard, community, do it.
Okay, very good. Okay. that's been one of the things that I think has, to a degree, been interesting about shortest path bridging development versus Trill, where SPB's had a very strong push about interoperability, or at least it did early on. I mean, Avaya has gone into their own extensions for SPB, certainly, and does things beyond the standard. But Trill has not been so fortunate as far as interoperability goes, at least not early on. Now, I know Cisco can operate in an interoperable mode, but it's the extensions that give a lot of the unique flavor and functionality that go there. And so when you see something really interesting happening, dealing with scale or dealing with multi-tenancy capabilities and so on, it's always a question that pops in my head. Huh? I wonder if this is likely to become a standard or just remain within the Cisco domain. And I know how Cisco's done this over the years. Anything that Cisco's had good success with, they try to encourage it to become a standard by engaging the IETF with drafts and so on, just to see where things go. And sometimes it happens, and sometimes it doesn't. So that was really the root of the question there.
Speaking of contribution, I thought this was the right time to also indicate that sort of the controller or the fabric management tool we've been talking about, which is the central point of management, and it's DCNM 7.0 for us. We have northbound REST APIs. They're open APIs for integration with third-party orchestrators. So we've done this for OpenStack as well as UCS Director. Specifically with OpenStack, we actually have about 5 blueprints that have been approved, and we are currently in the process of having those reviewed and being contributed towards Juno or JunoS or Kilo, which is the next versions of OpenStack. So that's been one of the major contributions from Cisco, to the community, and we got a lot of traction and appreciation for that approach, because in terms of people like the fact that we have these open APIs and we integrate nicely with the OpenStack sort of networking tool, if you may, where tenant creation, network creation information is populated transparently to DCNM or the central point of management, which gets populated with via the open REST APIs. This populates the config repository that we've been talking about, so that when a workload gets instantiated from, let's say, within OpenStack, that information is communicated over the Open Virtual Switch or the VDP extensions that we've contributed there. And that handshake between the OVS and the Tor to which that compute node is connected provides sort of the trigger to download that information to the leaf or the Tor, and hence completes the loop in terms of having an end-to-end solution without actually not having to go either to the leaf or to the DCNM at all. You basically just use OpenStack for network and tenant creations, and both your virtual as well as your physical network is auto-provisioned and ready with respect to traffic forwarding.
And think about that. When you have this VDP extension, as Shyam just explained, the VLAN itself is nothing else than the data plane between the virtual switch and the physical switch. So we signalize on a segment ID level already over the VDP, and the VLAN which to use is just the next available, because it's not relevant anymore for the network itself from an end-to-end connectivity perspective, from an end-to-end segment ID perspective. We just need it for data plane forwarding.
So just to restate something here that perhaps may not have come out in the conversation because we were being a little bit nerdy, you can have a VM move from one host to another, and the network, although it doesn't have VLANs configured in the traditional way, you haven't gone down and trunked VLANs over the backbone, the VMs can just work anywhere in the fabric, right?
It's total IP mobility.
Yep.
So it's with total IP mobility, you get total VM mobility. Mm-hmm. As we are having that enhanced forwarding approach, which is host routing based, it's all there. So it really moves seamlessly with it. And now think about the following thing. There is a technology out there in the world which is called Lisp. Think about having a leaf as a unique location and the host route, meaning a /32 or /128, because we're also doing IPv6, as the identifier. When you move your identifier, you keep it, right? You just change the location. So right. When you look at the concept, what we are doing with the distributed gateway, with the MPBGB control plane, we're basically doing a Lisp approach without the Lisp protocols.
Ah, okay. I was getting ready for you to say how you've been implementing Lisp and adding that to the solution. But in fact, you're not. You're just taking that model of location independence and putting it into this framework.
You got it. How smart is this, right?
It's the logical extension of, you know, the self-automated network. So I actually think of this as self-configuring. This network is self-configuring.
It can. It absolutely can completely self-configure itself based on the end hosts, but you do not need to. So we are CLI junkies, right? So CLI jockeys. We want to do that interface, VLAN, whatever you want to do there, my router, BGB, and so on. So all the modeling we're doing is a download, and it's very important. I love that pull model of the switch. It's a download of a configuration profile which we apply. If you do not choose to do this fully automated way of doing it, you just take the configuration snippets and enter it into the CLI. We're not changing anything on the CLI itself. We're just using existing tools to make it easy for you to do so.
And that's actually really important because you said, hey, we're CLI jockeys and, you know, we like to type stuff. Yeah, some of us are actually getting kind of burnt out on that. So if it could be automated, that'd be great, especially when you're talking at scale. Who wants to sit and actually manually key in configurations for dozens or hundreds of switches that are feeding a data center? It's so easy to get things wrong. It's a complicated set of cabling. There's a lot of stuff to nail up, and anything that would automate that process to me is great. Yeah, I want to understand how it works so I can troubleshoot it if it breaks and make sure I'm making the best possible use of the tools. But anything that begins to divorce the role of a network engineer from being a CLI jockey, I think is a good thing. There's lots of other things to spend time on. That's really a key.
So,
of course.
You know, now that you mentioned it, about two and a half years ago, when we initially started looking at data centers and especially the unified fabric as it exists and how do we scale out, that's exactly what we talked about incidentally. We said, you know what, you can't imagine that there'll be one person, a network admin, sitting here on his box. He says, oh, this workload's coming up, let me go and do the configuration. And then he goes to the other Tor and does that and keeps doing that. It just is not going to fly. So we have to do something about this, and a lot of these things what we've mentioned here sort of came about in incremental sort of innovations, and we were able to put down an end-to-end sort of solution with all these different pieces and have them unified, without making sound a cliche.
Well, you just hit on another thing that's really important here, which is with workloads moving all around the data center we want to be able to move them all around the data center. The network cannot become, an encumbrance that's waiting for some human being to manually provision. You need to automate all of those things just so that modern IT infrastructure can actually work as it's intended to work. There isn't any other way to do it.
Absolutely. Sure. And, like you said, so today, the way before how this is done or in the conventional sense, because you don't know what workload is potentially going to appear in what rack on what server, people typically go and enable all VLANs everywhere.
That's right.
And
exactly.
That clearly is a scale limitation, not only in terms of having these resources getting occupied on these devices, both hardware and software, when they may not actually be required, and also in terms of if you think about the port VLAN scale, which becomes really important if I have a lot of ports, right? And especially with FEX kind of architectures, where the number of server ports behind a pair of TORs can go, to a pretty large number, maybe in the order of even 1,000. And if I have 1,000 VLANs, we're talking about a 1 million potentially, port VLAN instances, both in software and hardware. And no matter what system you have, such a thing doesn't scale, right? It's just not a way to deploy and engineer and design a network.
Yeah, and I mean, you have software, right? You have hardware, so you all also depend on some tables. I mean, you might be able to have an ASIC with like a million of FIB objects, routing objects in there, but this is only one number, right? It's a multidimensional thing when you're building networks. It's not just one number you have to take care. And this is the beauty of the overall story, right? It's the beauty that you can use your existing network components. Let's think about Nexus 5500. It's there for how many years, right? You can bring the Nexus 5500 into the unified fabric. It's completely coexistence. I mean, we know about the routing capabilities of that box itself. It's actually not there. But from an L2 perspective, from a complete integration as well as automation perspective, we can put it in there. We can have it in there. So sorry about, again, I was in sales before. They call me now marketing guy right now. So it is investment protection. It's what's out there, what you guys know. We can work with that. It's not. We don't want to exclude it.
I'm looking at some of the presentations that you sent out, so I've got a couple of questions that I want to ask about. So if you're actually buying it, right, the first thing that you've got to buy is the central application, right? What's that called?
So the central application, you do not need to buy it. It's Cisco Prime Data Center Network Manager in version 7, and all functionality you require is actually free. Right. You download it from CCO. It's a virtual appliance on top of VMware. It's an OVA. You deploy it. You're good to go. You have a full packaged power and auto provisioning engine with DHCP, TFTP, as well as ICP, as well as prepackaged templates to build the network. Right. It's the LDAP server for the auto configuration part in there. You have like close to 40 profiles for tenant host configurations. It's there.
Right.
You build it up.
Just come back. There's something a little bit shocking in there. So you're saying I can go and get most or all of the functionality we talked about up until this point. It's a free software download from Cisco. You just have to have a CCO account.
That's correct.
You're
shocked, right?
Yeah, I'm just fanning myself. Nurse?
No, Greg. No, seriously. So the application is really go and download it. You will have fun with it. Now, of course, there are components within Cisco Prime Data Center Network Manager which has licensing requirements. For example, event handling, performance collection, the FC management part, meaning the storage side of the house there, the integration into vCenter if you want to, which is not required. Again, we do not require it. It's just when you want to get additional visibility of what your switches are doing from a traditional manageability perspective, there is a license for it. Mm. There's, of course, also maintenance, Cisco loves. We love to have service contracts and stuff like that. But for the DCNM application to do power and auto provisioning, to do auto config, to do cable management, I think this is one other good thing we have in there.
Yeah, I was coming to that because there are some things that you asked me to take a look at. And this cable planning consistency check is my next question, but let's push on.
Yeah, so that's all in there. And when we are at the cable plan and consistency check, have you ever cabled the network by your own? You know, you have these ports and you want to do it somehow consistently and it has to make sense and then you miscabled something, right? Let's go back.
Well, I don't.
Yeah, other people miscable, right?
Somebody else does.
Yes, this is the next problem, right? You engineer it. You make your exact design and tell somebody, go and cable it, for example. I mean, we still have to cable on our own, in our own labs, so you have the luxury to not do this. But somebody else cables it for you.
Yeah, how somebody else cables it because I'm not allowed in the data centers most of the time.
You see, how likely is a potential mistake there?
Yeah.
It can happen, right?
So
let's go back. So we were talking at the beginning somewhere about we model the network. So when you're creating your definitions, your power on auto provisioning definitions in DCNM, in the fabric management tool, you're specifying something which is called the fabric interface, so the fabric facing interface. So we have the information of all the switches which are defined in the templates, which are the fabric interfaces. Now let's go into the cable management application and just say, create a cable plan based on my power on auto provisioning definitions. He takes all of these interfaces and builds a spreadsheet how you could go and cable it together. And there is no switch currently powered up. There is nothing being cabled at that time. So it's really day zero operations, what you have in there.
So it's all, yeah, it's all based on the model. And then you can, you know, build out a cabling worksheet without some human having to do it, because the model can just take all that tedious work right off you and off you go.
It's an option you have, right? And once you build, bring up your network, your fabric, by using the power and auto provisioning approach, of course, we discover the network then. So we're building a map on how my fabric interfaces, my inter-switch links are cabled, and I can compare it towards the cable plan, which I did before, and I can lock it in that it has to be consistent with it. So if somebody goes and recables something, that port will never come up. We can enforce it. And you have the consistency between what's physically there and what you want to have.
Sure, okay. Yeah, there's an open flavor of this called Prescriptive Topology Manager. It does a similar kind of a function, but it sounds like you guys are doing it in a, you know, a slightly different mechanism there. You're using the management tool to make that all happen and then do the enforcement.
Well, the management tool is doing, again, the modeling and the distribution of the information, meaning the file being installed into the switches, but the switch itself reads out of the cable plan locally and checks the neighbor based on LLDP enhancements.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
It's, again, we are abandoning the centralized approach. We are completely distributed.
Mm.
It's how networks are today. Distributed control plane, distributed decision making, distributed connectivity. As there is no single point of failure there, right?
Yeah, there are different ways to achieve the same outcome here. The distributed control plane with self configuration, that an intelligent device, is a perfectly viable application of SDN, because you can have the application at the top that provides the single point of policy, if you want to think of it as that, right? The configurations come from there. You get the modeling and so forth. It's just a different way of doing it, say, from a flow-based networking system or from some of the other products that are out there that do different things, right? This might be a good point.
Calling it SDN, Greg.
Yeah, I think of it as SDN, right? Anything where you're using software to bring the network together is to one coherent tool, instead of treating each device as a unique snowflake that needs to be treasured, is SDN, sort of, in my opinion. I think there's more than one way to achieve SDN, right? Now, this might be a good point to take the discussion down. How does this compare to ACI? Did we cover that in the earlier stages?
I think we haven't covered it, but let me answer in this. So, first of all, the Unified Fabric is here for quite some time. We can call it the legacy network if you want to. It's how everyone perceived networking and so on and so forth. ACI is the big thing. It's a very nice, very different approach of doing networking from a more top-level approach. When we look from the OSI model, it's defined by the application. This said, these two technologies do not compete to each other. They're actually complementary to each other. Think about having today an existing network, and you need to bring in automation, but you do not have the budget to do anything. What are you going to do? Yes. And then at a certain time, you want to have an ACI fabric next to it for a specific application, or you got new budget, you want to build the next generation kind of data center thing. What is the interconnection between these two worlds? It's the Ethernet wire, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We push packets.
Yeah. So the customers who should really identify strongly with what we've talked about here is, you've got a network of Nexus 7000 down to 2000s. And you're looking for some way to bring it together to get faster provisioning, better visit, you know, that type of capability. You know, the SDN type of concepts that we've talked about, but there's no way you're going to be able to get new switches to change to some brand new technology that was only developed last year, you know, and you're frightened of the new technology because you're just not willing to trust, you bet your whole company on it. You can go and get this DCNM 7.0, add it to your network and start using it to bring together, you know, to build this new fabric out of what you've already got.
And there is a very big end on the end of this.
Mm-hmm.
Traditional network is each box CLI. So with going to the unified fabric, we're changing the operational model slightly and actually also let the operational as well as the engineering folks being ready to change the operational model one step ahead. We are already doing the collaboration between the teams. With ACI, we are combining that even more. So when you want to say it, it's a journey. It's a journey from the traditional CLI jockey over a slightly changed way of the operational model with automation and a distributed, fully out-of-the-box network approach, going to an SDN plus approach with ACI.
Yeah, so, you know, if you're boots and all in for SDN and you want the whole shebang of, you know, magic APIs and, you know, brand new shiny, then maybe ACI is what you want to be looking for. But if you're looking for something that's a more practical intermediate step, Fabric, you know, this is where you want to be, Unified Fabric.
And just to add here, maybe we hinted at this, that any of these different pieces that we mentioned about, right, the automation piece, the cable management, the power on auto provisioning, the host visibility, or even the distributed control and data plane, you can actually pick and choose. These are different independent sort of pillars, if you may. And you can, so for example, there may be some customers who may not be ready to start going auto configuration, full automation day one, right?
Yeah.
But they really like the distributed pervasive gateway and the control plane, and they're very comfortable with that. You can just choose that piece and then, you know, gradually go towards automation as and when you're ready. So these pieces have been made such that, you know, you can pick and choose from a menu, if you may, and you can incrementally go towards getting all the pieces gradually as and when you are comfortable with it.
So it's not an all-in. It's not like throw everything out, start again, put in a brand new fabric, start from zero.
Hey, it's a happy meal.
Yeah.
You pick and choose.
So we've got a lot of information that we've created here about, you know, what this fabric is, how it works, how it connects endpoints together. But one thing that has not come up at all is storage integration, which has been a big thing in the Nexus world. You know, its ability to do FCOE, including multi-hop. How does FCOE fit into Unified Fabric?
Perfectly, perfectly, Ethan. It perfectly fits in there. It's one of the elementary parts. So
I think we just engaged marketing mode there. Is that
right? Oh, yeah, of course. There's always marketing mode. So let's go practical. I mean, we had the Nexus 6000 series with only FCOE ports. We are now having the 5600 with also unified ports back. And there is a reason for it, right? So with the unified fabric, we have the capability to transport FCOE across the fabric itself. So we are calling this dynamic FCOE, and there are a couple of smart guys having a very nice idea of receiving FCOE traffic on the leaf or even FC traffic encapsulated respectively, transported across the fabric. And it's a single fabric, but we still separate the SAN A, SAN B approach in a virtual way.
And how does multi-hop fit into this at this point? Is it kind of the fabric look like one big hop?
That's true, yes. So when we look at the FCOE VE kind of interfaces, they're basically completely transparent through the spine layer. There is no special termination up there apart from how we balance the traffic around. So it's really leaf-to-leaf communication.
Ah, okay. Okay, so you know, shops that are invested in FCOE, which many of the Nexus customers are, they can move right into Unified Fabric and carry their FCOE commitment forward with them, and that's fine, good enough. So then let's look ahead. And this is a very feature-rich product already, but what about the future? There's always a roadmap. There's always things coming up. What's Cisco got planned for Unified Fabric?
There are multiple things upcoming towards end of the year. I want to highlight one thing, which is integration with MPLS networks. You guys know we are using multi-protocol BGP within the fabric. And of course, guessing enterprise service providers are having some MPLS core outside in order to communicate to other data centers or to the VAN, whatever you name it. With the Nexus 7000 or 7700, we have the beauty to combine both protocols in one single box. And yes, Greg, also in a single VDC. And we are using an approach, you could compare it to something like InterAS Option B. You can compare it. It's not exactly the right term which we are using there, where you have a fabric internal autonomous system having a border leaf directly imposing the labels towards the van. So there is no two-box approach there. It's really integrated in there. We call that Hub PE. That's one of them. The other thing is we completely go into automation of border leaf, meaning external connectivity whenever needed. If you're maybe not having an MPLS network, the VRF light approach, creating based on the VRFs, sub-interfaces, peering neighborship, and also the data center interconnect itself. So extending either with back-to-back connectivity between the border leaves or name it OTV, VPLS, whatever kind of layer 2 transport you have in between, it's all there. So we're going to bring that into the fabric management to model again these configurations and then pull it down or push it down, wherever, however you want to call it, whenever it's required, when that given tenant comes.
So that we want to qualify that a little bit, so that a single fabric management platform can see multiple data centers and manage the interconnect between them as well?
Well, that's our goal, which we aim for. Right now, we are single DCNM or single fabric managed per fabric. But there is, let's call it a handoff identifier in between, which we call the DCI ID, which we basically match then the two things together.
Okay, and you said end of year, so we're recording this in 2014, so you're talking about delivery in by the end of calendar year 2014?
I'm talking about the calendar year, yes. This is our plan to be in there end of this calendar year to have this functionality. And with this, there is also another functionality which we're going to deliver. Think about the following. Today you have the 4,000 VLANs per switch. What if you would have the 4,000 VLANs, meaning the IDs, per port? Would be that something exciting?
Yes, because just recently I've been doing a lot of research into things like containers, like Docker, and where one Docker can spawn 500 containers, one Docker server. And each one of those can conceivably need a VLAN. And, you know, with some of the modern servers holding, you know, you can now buy a server. I was talking to a guy on a high-performance compute the other day, and he's saying 2 terabytes of memory in a single system, 2 terabytes of DRAM is possible. They're now projecting it within 5 years. So if you think about how many networks you have to provide to be able to meet that requirement going ahead, 4,000 VLANs per port is not unreasonable.
And we're going that direction. Per port, VLAN significance, we map it to segment ID in the fabric, and again, it shows that the VLAN, which was before fabric global significant, comes now down to a per switch, or then even smaller down on a per port.
See, you're really talking about localizing the significance of a VLAN tag to an individual port, really making a very granular multi-tenant environment. Because I wasn't grasping it at first, and I think I'm getting it now.
You're getting it exactly right, Greg.
Okay.
That's exactly. Sorry, Ethan. That's exactly what it is.
Very good. So we've got a fabric you can get today. And if someone wants to go online and look up more about Unified Fabric, where do they go? Is there one of these cisco.com/go/tags, or should they drill into the Nexus area? Or
yeah, so we looked at it, and cisco.com/go/BSASDCNUF. They didn't want to give us that, so we're still at... No, they didn't want to do that. But we have one. So it's cisco.com/go/DFA.
Ah, DFA, okay. Very good. And so, Lucas and Shyam, thank you very much for joining us on the show today, and thanks to Cisco for sponsoring the show. Lucas, are you active in social media? Do you have a blog or a Twitter account that people could follow you?
Oh, I'm a bad blogger. I always write one blog and then it waits for another 24 months to get the second one. I'm not a very active blogger, but at CCIE21921, that's me on Twitter.
21921. Very good. Beautiful. And Shyam, right? same question for you. Are you active at all? Do you blog? And I know you're a Cisco Press author, so if you'd like to talk about your book or books, that'd be great.
Sure. Actually, I'm probably worse than Lucas in terms of doing a blog. I probably did one back when I did my PhD about 7 years ago. But having said that, at least I was happy to be, have some contribution to the community in terms of, there was a book that I co-authored with Padmanabham and Sanjay on overlays in massive scale data centers, considering Trill, Fabric Path, and VXLAN as special cases. So we sort of start off the book with, so the book got published in February 2014, just about, and it's actually sold more than 1,000 copies, so it's worked out really well for us. Mm. And it kind of covers, you know, why we need overlays, both host overlays or network overlays. Talks about, you know, has a brief survey of all the overlays that one is well known or, you know, are well known right now with respect to Lisp or NVGRE or SPB, et cetera. And then also talks briefly about using OTV as a DCI extension. So that's something, you know, we were working on it for almost two and a half years. And both with the unified fabric as well as, you know, the book coming out around the same time, it's worked out quite well in terms of timing.
Well, that's great. And we'll try to remember to put a link in for that book into the show notes if you're interested in that. Mr. Greg, what's the week hold for you, sir?
Oh, you know, the usual stuff. I think next week we're traveling, but it'll be start learning more about servers and x86s and the future of networking in software. So I think, you know that for us a common theme has been there's networking hardware, there's switches and the things that we're doing here, but increasingly we're seeing more and more things like software-based load balancers, software-based firewalls, and those types of things, and I'm looking to learn more about that with Intel in the weeks ahead.
Ah, and if people want to follow you, how can they do that?
They can follow me on my blog at etherealmind.com, which is my preferred location. You can use open technologies like RSS to follow me. But if you want to use more traditional medias, I'm also available on Facebook, and the Twitter is at etherealmind. And I'm also on LinkedIn and all the other fine locations.
And I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter, my blog, ethancbanks.com. And of course, Packet Pusher's home base is packetpushers.net. That is where you can find all of our podcasts and our community blog. And we still have an open invite if you're interested in being a community blogger. Send us an email. We'll get you set up with an account so that you can share with the world what's been on your mind. That is it for the show today, and one more time, we'd like to thank Cisco for sponsoring the Packet Pushers. If you have any questions about the show, you can write us at packetpushers@gmail.com using your fancy electronic mail, or you can tweet us on the Twitters at Packet Pushers. Please leave us a positive rating on iTunes and tell your friends. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.